tonight on Arena. We talk to the Coronas Quartet ahead of their Dublin trip and Netflix's Ripley and today's film releases up for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Or you can watch live on rte.ie/arena. Let's start tonight with film reviews. And up for review are Scoop, an insider's account of how the women of BBC's Newsnight secured Prince Andrew's infamous 2019 interview about his friendship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Monkey Man is the directorial debut of Dev Patel, where a young man makes a living in an underground fight club night after night wearing a gorilla mask. Yesterday we spoke to the director Andrew Gillimore about his new film One Night in Mill Street, the story of the high-stakes prize fight in Mill Street, County Cork, between underdog Steve Collins and the larger-than-life champion Chris Eubank. And Io Capitano tells the story of two Senegalese teenagers who embark on a journey from West Africa to Italy. However, between their dreams and reality lies a labyrinth of checkpoints, the Sahara Desert and vast waters of the Mediterranean. I'm joined by John Maguire and Cara O'Doherty. So we'll start with Scoop, a film based on the book Scoop, behind the scenes of the BBC's most shocking interview. It's written by Sam McAllister and directed by Philip Martin. Sam McAllister is a key character in the film.
So Sam McAllister worked on Newsnight and she was a researcher, and part of her job was to fix the talent, the people that were going to come on to be interviewed. And she was very dogged. The rest of her team aren't so keen on how she operates. They're thinking she's
the rest of the Newsnight team.
They think she's a bit tabloid in how she approaches things. But she has a great nose for a story, and she keeps an eye on Prince Andrew. And as the story about him and Epstein and his friendship starts unfolding, she's the one who says, right, I'm going to get this man, I'm going to get him onto the show. So it's about her journey to connect with the palace and bit by bit convince him that this is the best place for him to tell his story.
So you would think that the prince would be reluctant to do this interview. So how does it come about that he finally agrees to do it, John?
Well, I think he's backed into a corner, really, Kay. And the film does that extremely well, actually. It shows the desperation that he has, particularly when it comes to dealing with the media through his private secretary and a media consultant that they've hired. His private secretary, Amanda Thirsk, is played by Keely Hawes. And it's the relationship between Sam and Amanda, the Newsnight researcher, and the private secretary as the inside in Buckingham Palace, that really pivots Prince Andrew into the chair in front of Maitlis on the fateful night. It's not so much a car crash into it as it is a flaming 50 car motorway pileup of an interview.
Yes, Cara, because there's a key scene at the beginning of the series when there's a photograph taken, and that photograph is what really propels Andrew into this corner that John is talking about.
Yeah, it's that iconic photograph of Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein in New York in Central Park out for a walk, and it's quite fascinating. There is a paparazzi guy, Jay Donnelly, played by Connor Swindles, and it is quite amazing to watch the lengths he goes to get that photograph. He's a few missed opportunities and he finally gets that perfect shot, and this photograph is sort of blasted around the world. But I guess at that point, this is 10 years before the interview, the full significance of it isn't there. People know at this point that Epstein has been up to awful things, but how much Prince Andrew's connected to that is uncertain. So when Epstein is arrested, when all that information starts coming out, this photograph is now blazoned over everything. And that's the key that Sam uses to say, look, this is undeniable. There's you having the chats with your man in the park. There's no way to deny the situation. So it's about trying to get him on board. And the gas thing is that Prince Andrew really seemed to think that this was going to help his reputation. Mm. And there is, we were talking about it earlier, this kind of moment where it's awful, and yet he thinks that he's done a great job. He comes out going, oh, that's great, altogether, brilliant.
Let's listen to a clip from earlier, before the interview. Here, Prince Andrew, played by Rufus Sewell, meets with the Newsnight team to discuss the possibilities of an interview. Sam is played by Billy Piper, and she explains to him the public's view of him.
It's hard to imagine how I can turn it around, frankly. I mean, I have a lot of people telling me that it's a mistake me even being in this room.
And yet, here you are. And I can promise you one thing. You can't turn it around by staying silent. You know how people see you, don't you?
Why don't you spell it out?
Randy, Andy, Air Miles, Andy, this is sex and girls and planes and private islands and money. And with respect, the public see these stories and they think, yep, I can believe that. This isn't bad for your brand. This is your brand.
With respect? Well, sort of got a point.
Listen, I get it. Never complain, never explain, but I'm afraid those days are over. Yes, everyone has a voice now. Social media, Facebook, Twitter, everyone's having their say. And what they're saying about you is a lot stronger than anything I just said.
So Billy Piper there playing Sam and Rufus Sewell playing Prince Andrew in the Netflix series or film Scoop. So, John, so often in these things, you know, if you're talking about the deal, which was about Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, here we're talking about two incredibly well-known people, Prince Andrew, who has been known all his life and is so famous, and Emily Maitlis, also the presenter of Newsnight.
Maitlis is played by Gillian Anderson. And she's a hugely respected BBC veteran. And together with Sam and the Newsnight editor, Esme Wren, who's played by Romola Garai, the three of them take on this story. And they try to navigate the political and institutional obstacles that might prevent it from happening. And so we get this behind-the-scenes look at the first failed approach to Buckingham Palace, the negotiations, the research, fact-checking, the rehearsals that they have to do, and the interview itself. And we think, because we know this story intimately, that there is no tension anywhere, but it's full of tension and it's full of potential relationships that have the potential to be corrupted. And there is a point right up to when they walk into the room when you think he's going to step away from it, he's not going to do it, and we'll never get to the truth. And that's what the film really is all about, is that dogged pursuit of the truth, and particularly when it's powerful people who have things to hide. And that's what makes the film, that's what gives it this dramatic tension and makes it really interesting.
And Cara, are we looking at Gillian Anderson playing Emily Maitlis, or are we looking at Rufus Sewell playing Prince Andrew, or does that fade away after a while and you see the characters?
Oh, Gillian Anderson is so good with anything that she does. So, and I certainly had no fear going into this. I was slightly concerned about Rufus Sewell, particularly because he has a very distinct voice. And I did wonder, how is he going to lose that? Because he's not well known for changing his voice. And at the start, I think he just sounded a little bit like himself. But very quickly he settled in and he certainly looks the part. He has all of the ticks and all of the kind of, he's got those nailed down. He is padded out. There's some work done there, but they certainly play them very well. Yeah. And in particular, he is usually such a handsome man. And they've managed to hide that quite well.
What do you think about these films about journalism? I mean, obviously, it's an important story, but it is about journalism being very self-referential and very congratulatory
pat yourself on the back. But when you're facing a media environment where newspaper journalism in particular and television journalism, even Scoop, is set against a backdrop of the BBC announcing 450 cuts to jobs, they're reducing the amount of people that are working in their news departments. There's conversations about, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to do it? And all of the Newsnight team are under constant pressure and constant scrutiny as to the work that they're doing and the value that it brings to the organisation. That's common across all media organisations at the moment. So, yes, films will celebrate journalism, particularly a Scoop like this. This one, for the Royal Television Society, it was Scoop of the Year and Interview of the Year. Maitlis subsequently left the BBC and set up by herself with the news agents, a podcast that she does, very popular podcast. So, I mean, it was successful for individuals in terms of their careers, but also it was a win for journalism itself, and particularly holding somebody like Prince Andrew to account and having him lose his HRH title and be stripped of his frontline duties as a member of the royal family, which he still hasn't recovered from. I mean, that's really good, impactful journalism.
Okay, stars out of five from you, Cara, for a Scoop.
I'm 3.5 on this one. It really well performed, and I love the fact that it is a female-led story. So many often these great press films are very much men, the boys' club, and I love that aspect of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, 3.5, really enjoyed it.
A few, John.
4 for me, Kay. I think the director is Philip Martin, was the executive producer on The Crown, and he knows this world intimately. And identifying the locus that the story revolves around, the difference between how everybody saw it, we all watched this thing happen, and how Andrew saw it, and what the feeling, I think that's really the locus of the story, and he does that really, really well. So 4 stars, good film.
So our next film is Monkey Man, and this is Dev Patel's debut as a film director. Cara, maybe you'll tell us about Monkey Man.
So Dev Patel is a huge fan of action films, of John Wick, of Bruce Lee, and he was finding it hard as an actor to get work in this vein of things. So he decided to do it himself, which is fantastic. If you can't get work, make work.
Because we see him as a very gentle character,
yes,
even in Slumdog Millionaire.
Lovely. Optimistic, cheerful boy. Yeah.
So he, you know, there's this darker side to him. He wanted to do it. So it's a dark action drama that takes influences from a lot of those other kind of karate style films. And he plays this young guy who goes by the name Kid. He had an awful thing happen to him when he was a child, and he now fights for a living in an underground boxing club. And it's brutal. It is a brutal life. And as a child, he was told a story of a warrior monkey called, I'm going to say this wrong, Hanuman? Hanuman, thank you, John.
He's a god. He's not just a Hindu god. Yeah.
So he's always had this in the back of his mind, and he has a purpose in that fight club, and that's to earn some money to seek vengeance on the thing that happened to him as a child. And he takes the sort of the idea of this monkey man, his strength, his loyalty, his ability to fight, and he uses that to work his way up to wreak vengeance.
OK, well, let's listen to a clip. The kid, played by Dev Patel, makes a convincing argument to get a job when he speaks to Sita. That she is played by Sobhita Dhulpala.
Take this.
I don't want charity. What I need is a job.
This is King's. We just don't hire off the street. Where's your references? Your CV? Look, I don't have time for all this. You pass it over, John.
This. There's my CV. That's bleach. Chemical, oil. Give me the job no one wants to do. I'll do it. No complaint. This is all I know.
Anyone who talks outside these walls, anyone who forgets their place, doesn't turn out well for them. Understood?
Understood.
That does sound like a very different Dev Patel, very dark, depressed, desperate Dev Patel.
The stakes are high in the story for this character, Kid. And just like with last year's Or, that won the Oscar, this is the action extravaganza, the Bollywood movie, really, as a passionate declaration of identity. And it's rooted in Indian heritage. It's set in a city much like Mumbai. And history, it's about religion, it's about politics, nationalist politics particularly. It's about poverty, inescapable, the actual grind. He shot it in the slums of Mumbai. It's about corruption and social exclusion and the caste system. There's a middle section where he hangs out with a completely excluded, ostracized caste of transgender women who are working as sex workers, and they train him up in this big, long training montage, teach him how to be a warrior. And so there's a lot going on, Kay, basically, is what I'm saying. And on top of that, then you've got all the Bruce Lee stuff, all the John Wick stuff, punching and kicking and fighting. He tears a knife into a guy's throat with his teeth at one stage. That got a round of applause at the screening that I was at.
I guess he thought if he was only going to get one shot at directing, he might just try and take on everything, all the issues of India, and then also celebrate his action movies, which he loves.
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty much said that you know, and even the production was hit. They couldn't get funding, they couldn't get insurance. There's even one scene where a table gets smashed up, and between takes, they had to take the bits of table and actually glue them and sellotape them back together to reuse them for the next take. So, I mean, he put everything into it, includes he smashed up his hand and other bits of himself. He put everything into this. It's an absolutely highly, highly ambitious thing to do. Yeah. And as a first-time director, to tackle all of these issues and put some, he basically just said, yeah, this could be my one and only time. Yeah. I'm putting everything into it, including not the kitchen sink, but a few bathroom sinks that get flung across the place. It really is a highly ambitious and very imaginative as well.
So worth going to Stars, Cara?
Because he's a first time director, there's a few parts where the setup doesn't quite follow through, but it is so ambitious, very stylish, very dark. The fights are fantastic. And I'm giving him an extra star purely for his ambition. So 4 stars for me.
Oh, 4 stars for Monkey Man.
It is very brutal, though. So be mind yourself if you don't like that.
And from you, John?
Monkey Man is a bananas. Pardon me. As an experience, it is bananas at times. But it announces Patel as an action director. He knows what to do. He's also starring in this film as well. Completely against type. Completely against what we've seen from him up to now. So 3 stars for me. I would watch another Dev Patel movie, no problem.
3 and 4 stars for Monkey Man. Now on to One Night in Mill Street. We spoke to the director, Andrew Gallimore, last night. It's a documentary about the 1995 fight in the equestrian centre in Mill Street between Collins and Eubank. John, can you set up the fight? What's at stake here?
It's the day after St. Patrick's Day, 1995, pre-Celtic Tiger Ireland. Chris Eubank was on a kind of a UK tour. He was going to do 10 fights for £10 million for a satellite TV company. One of the boxers that he was supposed to fight got injured or didn't get a medical certificate to fight, so he had to go around to find somebody else to fight. So up steps Steve Collins, a puncher based mostly in the US, had come back to Ireland. Was trying to get his career started, and he was put forward for the WBO middleweight championship belt. It was a title fight. They held it down in Mill Street with Noel C. Duggan in the Mill Street Equestrian Centre as a location. They sold all the tickets in 20 seconds. It sold out, and it became a kind of an iconic night. The director, Andrew Gallimore, has done. He's gotten everybody involved together, put them in front of a camera.
Yes, he's got Eubank, Cara, he's got Steve Collins, he's got the promoters, he's got Noel C. Duggan, got everyone.
He's got absolutely everyone. And it's a fantastic mix of people. And the thing about them all is they're all great talkers and they're all very funny as well.
Yeah, that's the thing.
And
I was not expecting this to be as funny as it is. This is a funny documentary.
It really is. And they're such characters, the lot of them.
Let's hear a clip which gives a taste of it, because one of the funniest characters, though he may not mean to be funny, is Tony Quinn, because Steve Collins goes not to a boxing trainer but to a mind trainer to help him get ready for the fight. So Steve, in this clip, Steve Collins explains how he mentally prepared for the fight with his coach Tony Quinn. We hear Tony Quinn in the interview from the time about how ready Steve is, and then Barry Hearn, who didn't believe the hype from the Collins camp, but then Chris Eubank did.
I prepare for this fight in a way that I never prepared for a fight before. I've got my mindset and I'm ready now for anything he throws at me. Physically, mentally, I've never been so well prepared in my life. As a matter of fact, I introduced the guy who helped me prepare.
The issue has been raised that sometimes the mind tells the body when to stop. And people are worried that he may go on through the pain threshold and it could cause Steve some damage. And people are worried about that.
Yeah. Well, I think in something like boxing, the mind plays a big part in it. I mean, a lot of people in situations where they're very excited may actually feel no pain anyway. Many boxers, I don't think, feel pain till afterwards. Now, it's true, he will feel less pain than he normally would. I mean, that is definitely true. He'll also find that he's able to move much easier. For instance, one of the things we do is that I've slowed down, so when he sees the punches coming at him, they look about 3 times slower than normal. And we've done this in the training sessions, and it's worked very well. We've also made the target 3 times bigger. So it's much easier for him to be aware of what's happening. But of course, I've told him at the same time, and this is instilled in him, that he will be very aware of all dangers. In fact, he'd be much more aware than normal of any danger that may be to him.
What a load of rubbish. The only person who didn't think it was a load of rubbish was Chris Eubank. He thought it was black magic.
Yeah, Barry Hearn at the end there, he's very funny.
It's completely funny. Bonkers, isn't it? Yeah. And then, of course, Steve, the first thing that happens to Steve Collins is he gets a whack from Eubank.
He gets, that's a brilliant line as well. And Collins talks about the first punch. When they finally get into the ring, But it's not the only joke in the film, and maybe it's the span of time that has turned what was a very serious business. There was a lot of money at stake here, and it has turned it into something more lighthearted, or perhaps that humour and ridiculousness was built into the project right from the start. I mean, Steve Collins had a shamrock shaved into the side of his head. When you see it now, you're like, what was going on? Chris Eubank in the film misquotes Rudyard Kipling's If. I mean, it all just adds to the crack.
It is so much fun. I want you to stop because I don't want, in case people don't know what happens in the fight.
I know, the spoiler. There is potential for a spoiler.
Absolutely. It was a long time ago now.
Stars out of five from you, Cara.
Oh, 4 without a doubt. It is funny. There really are the fantastic characters. And I have to say it as somebody who works for Cork newspaper, Cork people will love this. Just chance they might see themselves walking down the streets. It's an absolute gem.
Well, that's the other value in the film, not only as a boxing documentary, a very odd and distinctive boxing documentary, but also as a snapshot of pre-Celtic Tiger Ireland and what was going on, a place that is instantly recognisable and yet utterly strange. I think it has value in that as well. 4 stars from me, Kay.
Two fours for One Night in Mill Street, which is really great fun. And finally, Io Capitano, which tells the adventure, journey, a tragic story of two young boys, Seydou and Moussa, who leave Dakar to reach Europe. Cara, you might set up this film.
Yes, they're two 16-year-old cousins, Seydou and Moussa. They're played by non-professional newcomers, Seydou Sarr and Mustapha Fall. And they're kids. They dream of moving to Europe. They're musicians. They want to become famous stars. And they have been squirreling money away quietly and working on the side to get enough money to do the long trek to Europe.
And obviously they live in poverty, but they have a very happy, contented life.
I don't know if it's poverty, really. When you watch what's going on in Monkey Band, it's Dakar, it's Senegal. They don't have a lot, but they, Garione, the director, is very, very careful about establishing just how rich the culture is, how comfortable their lives are in one way. They're not in utter deprivation. They don't.
So it's adventure they're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, they're just kids. They want 16, this better life. And they know they have to do this long journey by sea, by land. But at the end of the day, they're just kids and they think it's an adventure. And even when they do set off on that first bus journey, even the very first time they're stopped by border police and they're forced to pay over some money, even at that point, you can still see the glint in their eyes of, that's a bit mad. This is a mad adventure we're on. And the tragic thing is, and what we know is, these things go horribly, horribly. Oh, yeah. And as they journey on, they encounter horrendous things like trekking through the Sahara Desert, where people are just literally just dropping dead. There's traffickers who do not give a fig who they are, the fact that these are young people. There's babies, there's older people. They're just left to die.
Yes, John, because there's cruelty, but there's torture as well.
That's horrible, yeah. It's horrible. What they endure is really shocking and can be very difficult to watch. It's a harrowing film, but Garone and his writers interviewed people who did this journey from West Africa to Sicily. Famously, we've all seen it on TV, the boats arriving in Sicily. And the details of it, all the way as they cross the desert up into Libya, they get captured, they get imprisoned, they're enslaved. There's an awful scene in Libya where they're essentially in a prison / slave market where people are being traded. And it is a story of bondage, really. It's a story of these guys who have a dream but have to get through it in order to achieve that dream.
And this is the director of Gomorra and Tale of Tales.
Yes, an excellent filmmaker. But it is a story that has been covered before. The English filmmaker Michael Winterbottom in 2002 made In This World, which is a docudrama that followed two young Afghan men, refugees from a camp in Pakistan, to London. Very similar, schematic, really. A very similar film. But 22 years later, when you're watching Io Capitano, very little has changed for the better. And in fact, the situation is even more grave. And it seems trite to say, this is a very important film. But these stories are the defining narratives of our era. And when it's very well made and beautifully acted, particularly the lead, Seydou Sarr, he's a superb actor. And it is very, very affecting when you're watching a film like this. And his greatest asset, Garone's greatest asset, is Sarr, but it is the truth of the situation that really comes through him. It's harrowing at times.
So, Cara, What are your thoughts on Io Capitano, and how many stars would you give it?
It's strange to say that it's a very beautiful film, but it's because it is so harrowing. I find that those, particularly those torture scenes, just her even thinking about them now, I'm shook. But there's something very beautiful in it. The boys, you can see how they change as they go along. You can see them changing from kids into boys to these almost kind of aged men who have suffered from so much, and seeing their journey, and yet they still have empathy. It's quite remarkable. Strangely uplifting. It's 4 stars, but definitely watch it with caution.
And from you, John?
4 stars for me as well, Kate. It's really a film about our response to people fleeing war and persecution, poverty and corruption. It's really about how we in the West respond to these things. When we watch a story like this, you see this narrative played out over and over and over again. At what point do we do something about it?
So great films to watch this weekend. John McGuire and Cara O'Doherty, thank you so much. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Visitors to the National Concert Hall are in for a thrill when the legendary San Francisco Kronos Quartet play on Sunday, May the 12th. They're here as part of the 5 Decades Tour, celebrating a remarkable 50 years where the quartet have challenged and reimagined what a string quartet can be, transforming it into a living art form with exciting world and genre-wide collaborations, and importantly, responding to the issues of our time. I'm delighted to be joined by founding member and violinist David Harrington and John Sherba, also a violinist. Let's listen to Kronos Quartet first. This is a performance of their version of The Animals' House of the Rising Sun, arranged by Jacob Garchik. That was an arrangement of House of the Rising Sun, The Animal Song, arranged by longtime collaborator of the Kronos Quartet and performed by them. And I am joined by David Harrington, the founder member and violinist. But the other member is not John Sherba. It's Paul Wianco, who is the cellist with the group. And you're so welcome, David and Paul. David, you're a founding member, and I think maybe the only remaining member of the founding group. So can you recall your goals back then when you decided to set up the quartet?
You know, on September 1st, 1973, what I wanted to do was play Black Angels by George Crumb. And we started out by playing music by Bartok and Webern and all kinds of other people, until we had enough experience and the group was together enough that we could actually play Black Angels. Because for me, that piece was a response to the American war in Vietnam, and it pushed the string quartet medium into a role that it had previously not had, which was really kind of addressing issues and feelings that were happening right at that time. And in the last 50 years, not only have we played Black Angels, but we've played all kinds of music. And I can't wait for us to come to Dublin and play in your National Concert Hall. And we're going to bring some of our favorite recent pieces, and we're going to look a little bit into the history of the group. We'll be playing different trains of Steve Reich, which that piece changed our work a lot back in the late 80s. And we'll be playing recent music of Terry Riley and Jalen and Penny Chandrarini and a new version of Sun Ra's work. It's going to be fun.
There's a fantastic mix. And Paul, when you joined the Coronas Quartet, did you know that the message was going to be as important in what you did as the playing and the innovation of the music in the quartet?
You know, I grew up listening to the Coronas Quartet. I think I got my hands on a Coronas Quartet album when I was 8 years old. Which some would argue is too young for some of the insanity, the crazy noises that Coronas is capable of making. But it altered the trajectory of my musical life. I was already playing cello at that point, and I basically grew up with the Coronas Quartet throughout middle school, high school, college. Coronas was actively changing the musical landscape and changing the world with the music that they made. So years later, to get to join the ranks of my heroes, and with a sort of full knowledge of what I was getting into, and it sort of felt in a way like I had been in training to join the Coronas Quartet for all those years. And now it's just an absolute thrill to get to join in on the mission and the music making with these guys. It's difficult to describe how important and how joyous it is.
Yes, and David, you said there that Black Angels was the reason you set up the quartet. But since then, you have gone on having your wonderful quartet, but you want to collaborate with other people. You travel the world, and when you travel the world, you meet new composers or arrangers, and you come back after having worked with them. Is collaboration key to everything you do?
It certainly is. We have been so lucky to work with musicians from many corners of the world and the world of music. And we have felt strengthened, and we've been able to grow as listeners, as players, as imaginers of what music might be able to be. And, I should tell you that Coronas was in Ireland once, and my wife and I went to a concert. And it was Tony McMahon playing accordion and playing traditional music. Blew me away that we ended up working with Tony. We had to figure out a way to do it, but we did it.
That's right, because, David, we came across on Bukaline Bawn today with Tony McMahon and Coronas playing. So we'll play a little bit of that for our listeners, because I'm sure they'd enjoy it. there on Bukalin Bawn, there played by Tony McMahon with the Coronas Quartet. You obviously have fond memories of working with the late Tony McMahon.
I have absolutely wonderful memories. And when he came to San Francisco, we had such a good time in the recording studio and in concert. Yeah, Tony was one of the greats. No question.
Paul, the first track, a performance you're going to do when you come to Dublin is by Jelaine. It's called The Little Black Book. We've got it here, and I'd love if you'd introduce it for us.
Yes, Jelaine is a recent Kronos collaborator, a wonderful DJ electronic artist, and producer and thinker. And this piece is part of Kronos's 50 for the Future initiative, which is 50 scores pieces available to the whole world for free, with the aim of, you know, bringing those boundaries between young people and new music down. This piece involves electronics. I'm playing a kick drum at the same time as the cello. It's a whole lot of fun. A Little Black Book.
Little Black Book there, Kronos Quartet and Jelaine's composition. David, I mean, the programme is so varied, so exciting, and it's all building up to the Steve Reich piece that will end the concert. Can you explain this to us? Because it comes in two parts. It was inspired by a train ride that Steve Reich used to do as a young man in America, which got him thinking of what was happening at the same time in Europe.
Well, that's right. And Steve made this piece in the late 1980s. It's really the first piece he wrote that kind of deals with personal issues. And in that way, it's very important in his work, I think, where he's, as you say, imagining his own train rides in the 1930s, early 40s as a young person, and then imagining what was happening to fellow Jewish persons in Europe at that time. And there's really nothing like different trains in any piece in the string quartet repertoire that I know of. And different trains established Kronos as a group that needed to travel with our own sound engineer. And so essentially we became a quintet in the late 1980s, having our own sound person, because there's so many issues that need to be taken care of to make this piece work properly. And Can't wait to play it in Dublin.
Well, we're just going to play. This is from, so the beginning section is when it's the train is travelling in the States, and it's contemporary yes. to Steve Reich as a young man in the 1930s. And then the second part is about a train in Germany at the same time. And this is this section.
1940.
2nd. That's Different Trains by Steve Reich, performed there by Kronos Quartet, which will be one of the pieces the Kronos Quartet will perform at the National Concert Hall on Sunday, May the 12th, as they look back as their glorious 50 years in music. More information from nch.ie and David Harrington and Paul Wianco. Thank you very much. It's just coming up to 10 to 8. The character Tom Ripley was first introduced to us all the way back in 1955 in The Talented Mr. Ripley, a crime novel by American author Patricia Highsmith. In 1999, The Talented Mr. Ripley was made into a film by Anthony Minghella, starring Matt Damon in the lead role with Jude Law as Dickie Greenleaf and Gwyneth Paltrow as Marge, along with Cate Blanchett and Philip Seymour Hoffman. The film received 5 Academy Award nominations, including Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Supporting Actor for Jude Law. Now the novel has once again been adapted, this time for television, with the series Ripley coming out today on Netflix. This time, Andrew Scott has taken the role of Tom Ripley, with Johnny Flynn as Dickie Greenleaf and Dakota Fanning as Marge Sherwood. The series was written, directed and executive produced by Academy Award winner Steve Zelina. I'm joined now in studio by Jen Gannon, who is here to discuss the series. But Jen, before we look at Ripley, let's recall just how iconic the Minghella film The Talented Mr. Ripley was. Here are the key characters, Tom Ripley and as Ricky Greensleeve, and Tom Ripley, having fun at a jazz bar in San Remo.
Tu vuoi veri alla moda, ma se bevi whisky and soda, o ti senti disturbato. Tu appoggio il rock and roll, tu ci avvi al baseball, ma ci sono dei becchi a me, chi te li dà la posetta di mamma. Tu vuoi fare americano, 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 ma se non vuoi da lì, senza me non c'è sta niente a fa, ok napoletano. Tu vuoi fare americano, tu vuoi fare americano.
Parla in mezzo americano, quando si fa l'amore sotto la luna, come te viene capo di allo più.
Ok, together. Tu puoi fare l'americano, americano, americano,
se non è chi tu fa, tu vuoi vivere alla moda, ma si
baby, whiskey and soda. Why does anybody survive? What about the rock and roll? Do joke a baseball? My shoulder, back a man. Chitte l'idea, la borsetta di mamma. Tu a ball americano, americano, americano. Ma si nata in Italia, se da me non c'è sta niente a fa. Ok,
well, as they say, follow that. That was the original film, The Talented Mr. Ripley, with Tom Ripley played by Matt Damon and Dickie Greenleaf played by Jude Law. But Jen Gannon, now we have a new Ripley played by our own Andrew Scott. It's a TV series, so it's 8 hours, even though the film was quite a long film. But this gives time for the story to develop. Maybe you would just recall the story.
Yeah, for the uninitiated, the basic plot follows Ripley, who is scraping by as this run-of-the-mill con artist in the early 1960s in New York, and a wealthy man employs him to convince his wayward, vagabond, feckless son, Dickie Greenleaf, to return home from his playboy lifestyle in Italy. And when Ripley takes on this task, he's drawn into this very alluring world that Dickie has created, this kind of bohemian lifestyle in Italy, and complete with this picture-perfect girlfriend, very modern girlfriend in the shape of Marge. And he really, Ripley goes to extremes to preserve his place in that world where he feels like he didn't belong at one point and wants to belong there. But it eventually devolves into deceit and fraud and murder.
There is a bit of deceit at the beginning, because he doesn't tell Dickie at the beginning that he's there because his father has employed him to do so.
Yeah, and also there's, you know, the Ripley is the loneliest figure. I think that's very important. He's a shadow of a human who exists on, you know, the outskirts of life and humanity. And when he's offered this kind of opportunity to spring himself into this new, exciting, different place, he's going to use that. So he's not going to give the game away initially, because, you know, even when you see at the beginning of the Netflix series, when Dickie's father asks him to do this task, he refers to him as, oh, you would be one of Dickie's friends. And you could see this means a lot to him in a way, to be considered a friend, as if it's an alien concept to him. So he wants to inveigle his way into somebody else's life.
So believing that he has inveigled his way into Dickie and Marge's life, Andrew Scott, playing Tom Ripley, decides to come clean about he was paid by Dickie's father to come and find him. Let's listen to a clip.
Can you believe that? I mean, even if you knew my parents, you'd never think they'd go this far.
So who was the guy in the bar?
A private detective. My father hired a private detective.
To find Tom?
Yes.
Are you hard to find, Tom?
Well, I just moved, so yes, I guess so.
Why'd you wait to tell Dickie?
What difference does that make? You're missing the point of the whole saga, Marge. It's about my father, not Tom.
Have you decided what you want to see next?
Excuse me?
In Italy.
No. I haven't.
There's a lot to it.
I'm sure there is, but I think I'm going to stay here for a little while.
You know, if you're going to be here longer, Tom, you should stay at my place. I mean, why spend money at the Miramare when I have extra rooms, even if it is just my father's money?
I'd like that very much.
Great.
Thank you.
Andrew Scott there as Tom Ripley, Johnny Flynn as Dickie Greenleaf, and Dakota Fanning as Marge. So Marge already is pushing Tom Ripley away, wondering where he's going to travel in Italy, where Dickie is drawing him in.
Yeah, very much so. And that is the kind of basic dynamics of the core dynamics of the setup of it, because everyone's trying to figure out what Ripley's game is, what he's up to, why has he just landed in their lives in such a way that, and also, like, nobody can actually remember him. Nobody can get a grip on who he is. He's a very slippery character. But Dickie Greenleaf is a generous optimist, because his life has been so easy. So he will always treat someone with that kind of openness, because obviously, you know, with these, he talks about parties that they'd had in New York. York, and obviously everyone is a friend of a friend when you're at a certain level in society. So that open door treatment is given to Tom, and that is possibly the worst thing he could do.
So there are some, even though he's trying to ingratiate himself and get into this scene, Tom Ripley, he also is very pass remarkable to himself about Marge and about Dicky. Dicky's a very bad painter. Marge is a very bad writer.
And I think it's like there's a the thing that it captures really well is the new series is that isolation and that isolated kind of figure that Ripley is. And I think Andrew Scott's performance is the thing that people will come back to this series for, to understand, because I think what Stephen Zalian is doing is it's called Ripley. It's not called The Talented Mr. Ripley. It's called Ripley because it's focused on his point of view, his perspective. So when we first see him in New York, it's almost like he's living in a Hopper painting. It's like it's not even populated because he doesn't have those friends. He's not out on the streets. He's not going to parties. He's not going to dinners. He's, you know, somebody that's on a street at a certain hour where there's empty fire escapes. There's, you know, nobody in restaurants. He lives a solitary life. So when he's injected into these people's lives, he is kind of he would be severe on them. He is harsh on them because he's had to scrape by. He was, you know, we see him cashing bad checks and trying to defraud people out of little bits and pieces of money, and there is a desperation to him that's a quiet desperation that grows and grows as the series continues.
Now, as for people who would be familiar with the Mengele film, or for people who might have just binge-watched White Lotus in Italy, this is in black and white.
It's very different.
The difference is very, he's going for a completely different aesthetic,
it's
the director.
Startling. The difference is startling, and I think I think in the early tone, it feels a bit like another Highsmith adaptation, Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train. It has that old school noirish feel to it, with very sinister overtones. And I think he wanted it to be this faithful, in his mind, adaptation of what the novel would be. And that means black and white. And to be honest, the cinematography is breathtaking. And it is by Robert Elswit, who was responsible for There Will Be Blood, the Paul Thomas Anderson film, and Boogie Nights. And, you know, the imagery you have, it's almost like still photography. When it gets to Italy, you have the very cold quality of the marble statues against, you know, the kind of darkness of the tunnels and the alleyways that Ripley is frequenting. And it's very oppressive and atmospheric. But I will say, for me, that's a massive divergence from the Mengele film, whereas I think Ripley was centred on the seduction, the dance of seduction, how Ripley gets into these people's lives and what he wants for them and what he sees in this world. And you had, like, you know, the aquamarine of the sky.
But it is more successful, I think, as the Tom Ripley character, as the sociopath.
Oh, definitely. But I just think, you know, to take the colour out of Italy is to kind of drain it of its passion. And I found it strange for a story that is supposed to be about this sense of passion, this awakening of Ripley's envy. The series felt a little bit bloodless in that respect. But I do think, obviously, Andrew Scott gives a terrifying performance as this deeply psychotic character that you can't help but want to watch more of. He almost is, you could hear it in that clip, it's kind of Warholian, the way he presents himself with these little blandishments and these little phrases, and it's very unnerving. It's so entirely unnerving.
So, Jen, overall, would you recommend it?
I mean, I think it's an arresting period piece, and I want to see, you know, Andrew Scott do more of this. I think that's, you know, the era that he kind of, his face belongs in. He almost looks like a young Francis Bacon sometimes. But I do think, for me, the Mengele film is the golden touch. It's the one that is about how Ripley, you know, it wants to be in this world, and I don't think that captures why Ripley wants to be a part of this world. It captures him as a psychopath, but it doesn't capture him as maybe a human being.
Okay, thanks very much, Jen Gannon. Thank you. And Ripley starts tonight on Netflix. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy and Niall Fitzmaurice. Harry Buckless was on sound. David Phelan is the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby, and John Creedon is next after the news at 8.